America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Monday, the 14th of May. George Tenet has agreed to cooperate. This is actually a big deal. Henry Waxman, he's agreed to cooperate with a congressional investigation into the Niger fraud. The famous 16 words, you recall? And the statement today, Chairman Henry Waxman announced that the Oversight Committee will postpone the hearing with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice from May 15 to June 19. Now, why would he move it back a month? So that he can get George Tenet in to testify. Interesting. Mr. Tenet has agreed to cooperate with the committee's inquiry into whether the White House overstated Iraq's efforts to obtain uranium from Africa and its nuclear threat in making the case for war. Mr. Tenet has agreed to provide a deposition to the committee prior to the hearing. So this, he's been taking an awful lot of flack for this up till this point. And we will see. Legal Times, by the way, talking about how Monica Goodling is the key that is going to bring down Gonzalez. Though there may be a feeling that Gonzalez has at last stemmed the tide against him, it looks premature to declare victory before Goodling says what she knows about the Attorney General's and the White House's involvement in the firings. Frankly, my take on this is that this is going to lead right to Karl Rove. And we're seeing more and more and more of this. And it's just, you know, it's happening. It's happening. I don't think there's any way around it. There's two things, frankly, in my mind, very large issues in a context that has to do with who we are as a people. What kind of nation is this? What kind of nation do we want to be here in the United States? What is the future of this country? What is it? And frankly, what is the future of the world? Because in so many regards, as goes America, so goes the world. Although, you know, in some ways and at some places and times and whatnot, that is changing. But nonetheless, starting with John Kennedy and his discussions about secrecy and how it's the absolute antithesis of what, I mean, his, not him saying, obviously, what the Bush administration is up to, but essentially the same thing. I mean, this is extraordinary. First of all, a tip of the hat to Carl Wolfson, who does the morning show with me on KPOJ here in Portland, for tipping me off to this. John Kennedy talking about secrecy. And just as we talk about this and get into, you know, where are we today and how did we get there and where are we going? Just consider these words from John Kennedy.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it.
Now, this is where we get back to Monica Goodling and Gonzo Gate and Karl Rove, frankly. And Karl Rove manipulating, and this is where this whole thing comes into the voter fraud complaints. The Washington Post, May 14th. Nearly half the U.S. attorneys slated for removal last year were targets of Republican complaints that they were lax on so-called voter fraud, including efforts by presidential advisor Karl Rove to encourage more prosecutions of election law violations. I mean, this is a rubric to drive down the number of poor and elderly and minority voters who typically vote Democratic, and make it easier for people of wealth and largely white suburban affluent voters to vote. I mean, it's just really very, very simple, and it's a strategy that Karl Rove has been pushing really, really hard for 7 years now. In secret. It's starting to come out, but in secret. John Kennedy.
Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
And I would submit that we are there, and that we have a complicit media, that they have been covering up things. I mean, what is it going to be next? That Cheney was on the D.C. Madam's list? I mean, well, it's sort of the National Enquirer variety of things, but, you know, 9/11 and what's involved there, whether or not we're going to be going into Iran. I mean, this Zbigniew Brzezinski testifying. This is nearly a year ago. Brzezinski, the security advisor under Carter, talking about an attack on Iran.
At floor votes, he made his position clear at the outset.
I think it is obvious, therefore, that the American national interest calls for a significant change of direction.
Brzezinski provided a scenario in which further deterioration in Iraq could lead to U.S. military action against Iran.
If the United States continues to be bogged down in a protracted, bloody involvement in Iraq, and I emphasize what I'm about to say, the final destination on this downhill track is likely to be a head-on conflict with Iran and with much of the world of Islam at large.
And over the weekend, we see Dick Cheney, or last Friday, standing on an aircraft carrier threatening Iran. We hear now that the big headline, the White House says that they will negotiate with Iran. Well, about Iraq. What's interesting is that Condi Rice, and this is one of the things that was so understated, frankly, in my opinion, in the news throughout the last few days and over the weekend, was that Condi Rice went to Saudi Arabia and has been talking with the leaders of other Sunni countries, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, the United Arab Emirates. She was also in Dubai. Sunni countries who are helping to fund the insurgency in Iraq, the Sunni insurgents, the ones who are killing the vast majority of American soldiers. She's been going to these people and asking them to please stop funding the Sunni insurgents. And they're saying no. They're not gonna go on. So now we're having to turn to Iran. And which takes us back to Jack Kennedy. I mean, all of this entire policy of lies that were done in secret until the Downing Street memo came out. The lies that were done in secret that brought us to this point.
That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations.
It's almost like he's describing the entire Bush operation these days, and Kennedy wraps it up saying, ain't going to happen here.
And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, we will soon have a link over at AirAmerica.com as well for that. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Thanks again to Cliff and Chris and Jorge and all the great folks in San Diego, KLSD, who helped put together the gig that we had on Friday afternoon. It was incredible. And we're looking forward to being in Denver this week and Santa Fe, and I'll be giving you a little more information on that as we go through the program. But right now, it is time for
our Jaws alert for the day.
Look out, my friends. Well, actually, this is sort of the good news, I suppose. First the bad news. The bad news is lock your doors, bolt your windows, there's something in the fog, writes Kerry Truman over at the Huffington Post. That's a line from John Carpenter's classic 1980 horror film, but it also describes the basis of a lawsuit. What is it? Well, basically, farmers who are using pesticides and other things not good for, in the opinion of organic farmers, not good for all life, are drifting over and moving into the fields of farmers who are trying to be organic. That, nothing particularly new, just getting larger and larger, more and more of a problem. The flip side of that, of our Jaws alert, I guess our, you know, hey, we should be pleased about this. This from groovygreen.com, a site that keeps track of what's going on in all things organic. With all the frightening news over bee losses throughout the world, it appears that one tiny minor piece of information was overlooked. The losses are occurring in colonies besieged with chemicals and artificial additives. Organic bees are faring quite nicely, thank you, from the article. I'm on an organic beekeeping list of about 1,000 people, mostly Americans, and no one in the organic beekeeping world, including commercial beekeepers, is reporting colony collapse on this list, says Sharon Labchuk. The problem with the big commercial guys is that they put pesticides in their hives to fumigate for varroa mites, and they feed antibiotics to the bees. They also haul the hives by truck all over the place to make more money with pollination service, which stresses the colonies. So this is interesting. And certainly something that I suspect bears closer examination. Back to this issue of the confluence of so-called voter fraud that is trying to create the 1,000 years of peace, the 100-year Republican majority, Karl Rove's Republican 100-year permanent majority. And the Washington Post, Dan Egan and Amy Goldstein writing about this in the Washington Post today. Voter fraud complaints by GOP drive dismissals. We're finding now that increasingly that those attorneys who were dismissed were the ones who were not aggressively pursuing, quote, voter fraud, end quote, in ways that would cause people to think hysterically, oh, no, there's an epidemic out there of people who are trying to vote who shouldn't be. Now, we have, what, 20 actual prosecutions, successful prosecutions around the United States in the last 6 years? Many of them of people who just simply didn't know the rules. They didn't realize that as a felon, they were not allowed to vote, for example. or like Ann Coulter, let's cut her a little slack and say that she didn't realize that it was a federal crime to register as her voting address, her real estate agent's address. She probably wanted to keep her home address private, and a lot of public figures do. So that's the kind of thing that, and they use this as then a justification to pass these draconian ID laws that make it almost impossible for people like my mom, for example, who hasn't had a driver's license since the mid-1950s, to vote. So you combine that with the fact that these guys are getting backed into the corner now, and seriously backed into the corner. What happens when you back a small rodent into the corner? They tend to lash out. Back to Zbigniew Brzezinski, predicting what will happen if Iraq melts down.
A plausible scenario for a military collision with Iran involves Iraqi failure to meet the benchmarks, followed by accusations of Iranian responsibility for the failure, then by some provocation in Iraq or a terrorist act in the United States blamed on Iran, culminating in a quote-unquote defensive U.S. military action against Iran that plunges a lonely America into a spreading and deepening quagmire, eventually ranging across Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan.
Now, Pakistan, of course, being a nuclear power. And this is not some wild-eyed conspiracy theorist or some, doyen of the left. This is Zbigniew Brzezinski, the arguably very conservative, very thoughtful, brilliant man, the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, the guy who held in the Carter administration the job that Condi Rice held in the Bush administration when she ignored national security for the first 9 months and, 9/11 happened. So are they going to drive us into another war using the secrecy to hold power? 27 minutes past.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Speaking of eerily reminiscent, you recall over the last couple of weeks, actually over the last several months, there have been numerous reports in the media that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN inspection agency that makes sure that people are appropriately using nuclear power and the technologies associated with it so as not to build nuclear bombs. The IAEA, it's been reported over and over and over again, was not allowed access into Iranian nuclear facilities. And I would submit that probably the majority of Americans, if anybody were to ever conduct a poll, the majority of Americans would say that, yeah, the IAEA has not been allowed access. So many people believe this, that Mark Vidrakar, who is the spokesman for the International Atomic Energy Agency, felt provoked to get out ahead of this thing. This is from ABC News. Now, that ABC, as in Australian Broadcasting Corporation, oddly enough, not the ABC in the United States. And isn't it interesting that it's showing up there and not here? The United Nations nuclear watchdog has denied a report that Iran blocked its inspectors from visiting a nuclear facility where it is enriching uranium. There is no truth to media reports claiming that the IAEA was not able to get access to Natanz, said IAEA spokesman Mark Vidrakar. We have not been denied access at any time, including within the last few weeks. This is a report that was published today by the official Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. I've been on several of their programs a number of times when I've been in Australia. It's sort of like PBS here in the United States, or BBC in the UK. He said, we have not been denied access at any time, including in the past few weeks. Normally, we do not comment on such reports, but this time we thought we had to clarify the matter. If we had a problem like this, we would have to report to the 35-nation IAEA governing board, but that has not happened because this alleged event did not take place. Now, this most recent attribution, this most recent story came out of from an unnamed diplomat in Vienna. It sort of reminds you of what Bush was saying shortly after we invaded Iraq. I mean, this was one of the so-called rationales for invading Iraq. Remember when George Bush, during a press conference, he was asked, you know, well, why did we go into Iraq? And this was very early on, and he had this to say.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, did Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let him in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Now, you know, that bears repeating because the UN weapons inspectors were in Iraq consistently. IAEA, Mohammed El-Baradei, testifying before the United Nations. You had Hans Blix saying that, you know, he didn't find anything. There's nothing
there. I've not ever suggested that they were sort of willfully and consciously lying.
He's talking about Bush.
But I think that they wanted to jump to conclusions. I said in the Security Council that if something is unaccounted for, it doesn't necessarily mean that they exist.
And he goes on to say, you know, basically, we didn't see it. And it was the United States that pulled out the inspectors just before the bombing began because both Baha El-Baradei and Blix were saying, you know, we don't think we're going to find anything from everything we're seeing here. It doesn't look like there's anything here. But Bush is saying.
And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
Which is just a bald-faced lie. It's a bald-faced lie. And people say, oh, how dare you call the president a lie? Well, and now we're hearing again, well, Iran won't let the inspectors in. And so the IAEA is getting out ahead of this one now. They're saying, sorry, not true. We are letting the inspectors in. So it's really quite remarkable. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Prez in San Francisco, California. Hey, Prez, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I wanted to talk about several things, but the media is the main thing. I have a couple points to make about that, but it goes back to the FCC and Michael Powell. It's a very important thing, and we need to do something about the election campaign funding and everything to get these senators and congressmen to regulate the FCC to get them to do their job and have these corporations actually perform like they're supposed to for their licenses every year for the public good.
Yeah, we have major transnational corporations that are making decisions about what we're going to hear. Many of these corporations, very little loyalty to the United States. In fact, much of their business is done outside the United States. In some cases, even edging on a majority of it. Is that a healthy thing for democracy? I tend not to think so. Dave in Buffalo, thanks, Prez. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave.
Hello, Tom. Hey, I was wondering, is the president subject to the RICO laws?
No, but the Republican Party could be.
And,
well, actually, the president may be. You know, the RICO laws are the laws that allow you to investigate organized crime, essentially, conspiracies. And there's the thing about, I don't have it in front of me, and it's been probably two or three years since I actually read the RICO statutes. We did a program on this maybe two or three years ago, you know, an entire hour basically on RICO.
I know missing money is one of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's very narrowly defined. It was in the beginning intended specifically to go after the mafia, and they didn't want to make it too broad because they were afraid that it would fail the Fourth Amendment test, that it would get knocked down by the Supreme Court. And I think that there are some provisions under RICO that you could argue may have been violated, certainly by Roe or by the Republican Party. But the president himself, you know, you'd have to bring him. I mean, the constitutional remedy for what the president is doing is impeachment. It's really simple. And putting forward articles of impeachment in the House of Representatives means you initiate an investigation. And there's a whole bunch of investigations going on, and I realize I'm just absolutely schizophrenic about this. I have for a year been calling for impeachment. The last few weeks I've been thinking, you know, we need to build a critical mass of this guy is committing crimes before we go any farther. And at the same time, it just seems like the impeachment process is one that could bring that back, and it could bring about the investigations that would bring about, you know, some reasonable understanding of what this guy has done that is criminal. And it's not just Bush. I mean, it's this entire Republican and neocon machine that has been operating in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, brings us to this interesting question. Chuck Hagel and Mayor Bloomberg. Bloomberg, a billionaire who has said that his idea of good financial management, of good estate planning or good financial planning is when the check that you write to the undertaker bounces. In other words, you can't take it with you. And he's got $1 billion or more. And Chuck Hagel, who is an old protege of Bush Sr. and the former president of the company that became ES&S, you know, election systems and software, the ES&S, the voting machine company that counts most of the votes in the United States. And, you know, there's speculation that they might make a third party run, or frankly, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see these guys ending up running for president. Hagel, Bloomberg? Wouldn't surprise me at all. It's been three, I think maybe 4 years now since I wrote the article suggesting that Chuck Hagel would be he's the guy to watch. Because he's the guy who used to own the company, the voting machine company, and he's the guy with the ties to Bush Sr. And I think that there's been a substantial estrangement between Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. And the consequence of that is that Bush Sr. has been looking for somebody to carry on his legacy, who is his new protege. For a while there, it was Bill Clinton, and may well still be Bill Clinton. But, you know, Chuck Hagel has roots that go way, way back, at least that's my understanding of it, to Bush Sr., and it'll be an interesting one to watch. It's going to be a very interesting one to watch. Kevin in Everett, Washington. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Appreciate you taking the call. Hey, quick question, or quick thing about something you've been talking about that you kind of made me think about. You talk about how we're sending all this money over to China, and they're holding all this debt. And for those out there that want to think about it, read Genesis chapter 24, the story of Esau and Jacob. Esau sold his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of soup, and I got a feeling we're doing the same thing, and we're just not going to.
Big time. In fact, there was an article in, I think it was Friday's paper, I believe, it might have been Thursday's, when I was traveling, in the Financial Times, this big front page article that I read in a, you know, going through an airport, about how this enormous capital surplus that has accumulated in Asia, over $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion, is becoming the engine that is pushing the rest of the financial world, you know, not just the manufacturing world, and growing concern about how it's going to be used. And I, you know, frankly, 26 years of conservative economic policies, the insanity, the Lexus olive tree, world is flat, Tom Friedman, Milton Friedman, you know, this just general insanity, and starting with Reagan and then Bush Sr. and then Bill Clinton with his so-called free trade, all of these policies, the confluence of these policies is that America is no longer a superpower. We're no longer even arguably a first world nation because we are now the largest debtor in the world and the largest importer of finished goods. Yeah, absolutely. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
In the sign said, everybody welcome, come in, kneel down and pray. So they passed around and played at the end of it all, but I didn't have a penny to pay. So I got me a pencil and a paper, and I wrote my own little sign. It said, thank you, Lord, for thinking of me. I'm alive and doing fine. Yeah, sign, sign, everywhere, sign. Flogging out the scenery, breaking my mind.
As one of the signs, I think it was one of the benchmarks, figuring out what to do with Iraq's oil. And there's a lot of concern about this, that the United States is promoting a program in Iraq that's basically going to turn Iraq's oil over to American corporations. Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey of California, the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which Bernie Sanders started back 16, 18 years ago, something like that, and the 72-member, and the 76-member out of Iraq caucus. She's also the co-chair of that. She voted against the supplemental bill because it still includes provisions concerning Iraq's oil. She says, all I can say is that I'm not satisfied that what we're doing will actually benefit the Iraqi people and not billions of dollars for oil companies. God bless you, Lynn Woolsey. Antonia Juhas of the Institute for Policy Studies says there's absolutely no reason why the United States should be involved in those discussions, that being, you know, about oil. Juhas, Woolsey, and others fear could play out poorly for Iraqis. This is from a UPI article about this. This bill does state appropriate money cannot be used to, quote, exercise United States control over any oil resource in Iraq. That sounds very good. That's very nice language. But if Halliburton controls something or ExxonMobil controls something, does that mean U.S. control? No, these are private companies. In fact, Halliburton is becoming a UAE company. They're moving to Dubai, remember? It's a concern, says Lynn Woolsey. It should be debated. It should be out in the sunshine. Which brings us back to the quote that we opened this hour with, of John Kennedy's talking about secrecy and how we are not a nation of secrecy. And it's particularly in politics, the democracy can't function without an open and honest debate about the issues. As Lynn Woolsey says, it should be debated. It should be out in the sunshine. What does it mean, and how many of our troops would have to stay just for that reason, just for the reason of the oil? So we'll see. We'll see how this all shakes out. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Ralph.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I think I figured out the Karl Rove killer strategy.
Mm-hmm.
It's McCarthyism in 2010. Four steps. One, we are and will lose in Iraq. Nobody questions that, really. Two, Bush keeps us there until the 2008 Democratic victory. Three, the United States loses Iraq. Four, blame the Democrats for losing Iraq. McCarthyism almost destroyed FDR's legacy after the, quote, loss of China. Here we go again.
Yeah. The not just the loss of China, also the whole thing with Korea.
But it's the ability to say the Democrats are the ones that destroyed the American dream.
Ralph, I believe that you're absolutely right in terms of the strategy that the Republicans are considering, and you can see them setting this thing up. Whether it'll work, whether it'll play out or not, that's a whole other thing.
But now we at least know what their strategy is.
Yeah, one of several. One of several. Another one is this whole issue of let's try to get as many people off the voting rolls as possible who might possibly vote Democratic. And others have to do with let's transfer hundreds of millions, if not billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, it was, not hundreds of billions, over $1 billion, $1,000 million was given to religious organizations, for example, in the year of 2004, leading up to the 2004 elections. So it's help out the religious right that's on the side that has joined into an unholy alliance with the Republican Party on the one hand. And on the other hand, let's see what control we can have over who gets to vote and when and not and all that sort of thing. Wayne in Seattle. Hey, Wayne.
Hey, Tom. Just a couple quick questions. You know, back in the day when Cheney held his little energy meetings, I knew that we couldn't get back into those records because of the Supreme Court and Scalia, the Freedom of Information. Is there any way to revisit that? Because I think that's...
Well, My recollection of that Supreme Court ruling was that Cheney eventually would have to release that information about who attended those energy meetings. He just didn't have to release it before the November elections. And, we'd have to go back and look at it again. We did report on it rather extensively at the time, though, and it was one of those mixed things where there was no clear winner or clear loser. Cheney did get to keep it secret over the elections, and whether anybody's going to pursue it now or not or not, I don't know.
Keep in mind,
it was Judicial Watch, you know, this right-wing organization that engaged in the initial lawsuit. Larry Klayman, the head of Judicial Watch, was the guy who, through his lawsuits around Paula Jones, unearthed the whole Monica Lewinsky thing, which, you know, so on that went. Speaking of Monica's, Monica Goodling is up next. Jamie in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Tom. Great show. My question was, I was worried that Monica Goodling might end up like Ollie North, kind of the martyr fall guy type, and she'll take the blame for all these crimes and then just be like a Republican hero.
Yeah, another Ollie North.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's conceivable. It's conceivable, and I don't know. We'll see.
I just want people to think about that.
Yeah, I don't think that she is that sophisticated or that Machiavellian. But
Rove's going to coach her, though.
Yeah, well, maybe not. I mean, you know, she has separated herself from the government, so it's possible that we won't see that. And Ollie North was the master at that kind of stuff. So this is going to be a very interesting one to watch because her testimony is immunized. If she's lying under oath, in this testimony, then she's going to have some huge problems, and she's basically going to have to answer any question no matter where it goes, because she's been given immunity. She can't, you know, she can't invoke her Fifth Amendment rights. And I frankly believe that this is going to go right to Karl Rove. This is going to go right to the White House. Wouldn't surprise me at all if this goes right to George W. Bush. Which brings us to the crux of the issue that I'd like to discuss in our second hour, along with other news of the day as well. And that is, what is the conservative plan for America and for the rest of the world in terms of the quality of life of individuals? And how are we seeing this thing played out right now? In a battle between the Defense Department and the State Department, of all things.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. America from the weapons of mass deception.
Now, to bring this back to the last hour, and welcome back to the program, by the way, to bring this back to the discussion in the last hour, which was in large part pointing out the fact that this administration, not just this administration, that the Republican Party, and frankly some conservatives in the Democratic Party, that, in fact, should probably strip party out of this, except that the Republican Party has been acting like some sort of an organized crime institution. That they are engaging in wholesale election fraud, throwing 70, 80, 90,000 people off the voting rolls in Florida in the 2000 election, 100,000 people off the voting rolls in Ohio in the 2004 election, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. And somehow, whenever there's strange things going on with voting machines and whatnot, it always seems to benefit the Republicans. Just always seemed, it's just one of those kind of miraculous things. So, and pushing these Department of Justice attorneys, these U.S. attorneys, so hard to pursue these so-called vote fraud issues. In other words, provide a justification for laws that make it harder and harder and harder for people to vote. Because as Paul Weyrich, the Republican strategist, pointed out, they really don't want people to vote. Paul Weyrich, the godfather, the grandfather of Republican strategists, the guy who claims credit for getting Reagan into office, the direct mail genius, the campaign consultant to the Bush campaign in 2000 and 2004, speaking to a group of Republican activists in a church.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So drive down the voting populace. That's what the attorney, that's what Gonzogate is all about. That's it in a nutshell. The whole thing of the reason why Karl Rove, via Monica Goodling, because she was the liaison between Rove's office, between the White House and Gonzo and Alberto Gonzalez. The reason that the message being communicated through Monica Goodling and, you know, come up with these lists, purge these people, get rid of the whole thing, and was about driving up the appearance of voter fraud and minimizing any prosecution or stopping any prosecution of election fraud. Election fraud where you knock 100,000 people off the voting rolls because they committed the crime of voting while black, for example, or voting while poor, or voting while elderly. How dare they? They're going to be concerned about Medicare and Social Security. We can't have that. What this all comes back to is the reason that the Republicans have to do this and the reason conservatives in general have to do this is because the majority of Americans don't agree with that worldview. They actually want there to be a middle class. They believe that the government should be here to backstop us, that we should have been there when Katrina happened. We should have been helping to rebuild New Orleans right from the get-go. We should have been ready. And we weren't. But for 26 years now, we have had, you know, with some small exception during the Clinton years, and I do give Bill Clinton some credit for what he did as president of the United States, at least in this regard, understanding that government, and he's talking about it actually a lot now, to his credit, when he came and spoke in Washington State for that fundraiser for Jim McDermott, where I emceed the gig. His whole talk was about how conservatives think that the quality of a nation is determined by the wealth and power of its most powerful institutions and people, whereas liberals, traditional Americans, believe that the quality of a nation is determined by the quality of its middle class, by the quality of the institutions that backstop people. And that's traditionally government. But Reagan turned that around. In 1980, there was literally a sea change. This country went in a completely different direction. You had, before that, even Republican presidents like Dwight Eisenhower saying there are a few people who think that they can do away with Social Security and programs like that. They're mostly millionaires, oil millionaires from Texas, and they are stupid. They are wrong, and they are stupid. But they came to power in the election of 1980 with the help of the Iranians holding the hostages. Had that not happened, I mean, Jimmy Carter, 6 weeks out, was way ahead in the polls. And then the hostages happened. So anyhow, Reagan comes in and starts this new meme.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And now this is being played out in Iraq. This same war on the American middle class, this same belief that if you have a true middle class in a true democracy, or a constitutionally limited democratic republic, for those of you who are obsessive about actual literal words, you know, making it, being very specific about it. If you have that, traditionally Americans and liberals have said that's a good thing. The definition of a middle class being Teddy Roosevelt's old definition of if you, regardless of the kind of work you do, whether you're a janitor or a CEO, whether you're a car mechanic or a pizza delivery guy or working in a factory or whatever it may be, regardless of the work that you, we honor all work. Whether you're picking lettuce in the fields or whether you're selling things at Bloomingdale's, doesn't matter. If you put in a 40-hour week, and of course back when Teddy Roosevelt was promoting it in 1912, it was a 50-hour week. 1913, when he was running as a progressive, the Bull Moose Party. If you put in your time and you play the game by the rules, and you put in an honest week's work, you can or you should be able to, Teddy Roosevelt said. Have enough money for your retirement and know that you will be safe in your old age. Know that any kind of medical emergency you will be able to handle. Be able to put your children through school, including college. Be able to take a vacation every year. Be able to live in a way that allows you to acquire the equity of a home, you know, own your own home eventually. Own your own car. Not be in debt to the mortgage company and the insurance forever. I mean, over time, eventually acquire these things. Basically be self-sufficient. Have, you know, at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, you know, that safety and security. Have safety and security under control in exchange for working that 40-hour week. Now, the conservatives looked at the American experience. And by the way, this has been replicated in other parts of the world, but specifically America. They looked at the American experience in the 1770s when there was arguably the largest and strongest American middle class. Yes, it was based on the back of slavery, and it was based on the back of stealing land from Indians, Native Americans, and you know, I mean, we can question the morality of the basis of it, but it was there. There was a large and strong middle class. And what did it lead to? The Revolutionary War. You had a strong middle class in the 1770s, the strongest middle class in the period from 1617, I think, when Jamestown was founded, or 1619, the early 1600s, certainly through the Civil War, by which time the middle class was completely collapsing. And then the second time that there was a peak of the middle class was in the 1970s. And what happened? Again, you had people out on the streets saying, hell no, we won't go to your crazy war, and women burning their bras and saying, you know, women's liberation, and gays saying, you know, we're part of society too, and African-Americans and minorities of all stripes saying, hey, wait a minute, we should be part of this. You had people calling for an opportunity to participate in that ideal of a participative, elected, representative, constitutionally limited democratic republic. So now this is being played out in Iraq. See, the conservatives look at this and they say a middle class is a terrible thing. You want to have the working poor and the wealthy. The wealthy will provide stability. The working poor will do the work. But don't give them enough free time that they can get politically active, or you're going to see the 1770s and the 1970s repeated all over again. And traditionally, Americans and liberals look at what happened in 1770 and in the 1970s and say, you know, that was a good time. There were times of social ferment, but that produced the kind of change that produces a better society. And now there is a war going on between the Department of State and the Department of Defense in Iraq about this issue. I'll tell you about it right after this. 16 minutes past.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Join us on the 17th in Denver, Colorado. I'll be doing a live show from the Boulder Theater, 9 a.m. to noon. You can get information over at am760.net, KKZN, AM760, putting the thing together. Should be a lot of fun. And on May 19th, KTRC in Santa Fe, at the Greer Garson Theater, we'll be doing a presentation and book signing. To get tickets, listen to KTRC to find out how. And speaking of Santa Fe and that region, actually, Albuquerque, down the road quite a ways, but in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where we're on the air on KABQ, AM 1350. This is amazing. There's a sculpture that was commissioned by the city And I have photos of it here. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Glass and I don't know if it's bronze or steel or what, but it's a lot of glass work in it. And it is called Ancient Sunlight. And the artist is Denise Taylor, and she sent us a note saying a friend of hers, Chris Thobe, gave her a copy of my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and she says, your book inspired me to make this sculpture, which I was commissioned by the Albuquerque Uptown Shopping Center in Albuquerque to construct. And it's, I'm honored. It's on Louisiana Northeast in Albuquerque, and a beautiful sculpture. It's between the Elephant Bar and the Bravo Restaurant. So those of you in Albuquerque, go see an extraordinary piece of art. So a lot coming up. So anyhow, here's the... Back to, you know, the death of the middle class and all that sort of thing. This all has to do with a guy by the name of Paul Brinkley. He's the guy who's bringing this to a head. It's interesting how the situation has basically reversed. When this is today's Washington Post, you know, giving credit where credit is due. And by the way, a call out to the existentialist cowboy for that great Brzezinski video and an interesting story on that as well. Anyhow, Paul Brinkley is a deputy undersecretary of defense. Now, the Department of Defense is getting all this heat to ratchet back on the insurgency, and they've figured out what Eisenhower knew. I mean, Eisenhower, who led the he was a supreme Allied commander in Europe, led the American invasion of Europe in World War II. What Roosevelt knew, what Truman knew, certainly Truman with the Marshall Plan after World War II, what General George Marshall knew, is that if you give people jobs, they will not shoot at you, they will work. People would always rather have a job than be insurgents. It's not, you know, people don't just, hey, let's go off and join the insurgents. No, if they've got a decent job and they can raise their families and put their kids through school and all, just all that kind of simple generic stuff that we were talking about in the last segment, if they can do that, then you don't have an insurgency. And so Paul Brinkley, who is a deputy undersecretary of defense, is now strongly arguing that the way to solve the problem in Iraq is to open up some of the formerly government-owned factories, even if it takes the government opening them up, and put people back to work. Now, this is a because this is a variation on what Franklin Roosevelt did back in the 1930s with the WPA and the CCC, the Works Progress Administration, Civilian Conservation Corps, and others, where the government says, okay, if nobody else will give you a job, we will. And Roosevelt, in part, was doing that because he was getting so much pressure from the right and from the left. There literally were fascists and communists in the United States, both, you know, well-intentioned people who, by and large, because nobody had seen the end play of fascism or of communism in that form back in 1932. And Roosevelt thought, you know, if we're going to preserve American democracy and free enterprise and regulated capitalism, then we're going to have to put people back to work. And here's this guy, Paul Brinkley, Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. He's running around Baghdad trying to put these things together, and this is the Department of Defense's new plan, or a piece of it anyway, his piece of it, to stop the insurgency. Give them jobs. And who's trying to stop him? Condi Rice in the Department of State. Why? Because the neocons say, oh, no, this should be the free market. In fact, when L. Paul Bremer came in, that was the first thing he did, was shut down the factories. Wait for private investors to come in. Private capital will come in. Everything will be fine. As the Washington Post notes today, disagreements among Americans about how to deal with Iraq's government-run businesses began shortly after U.S. forces arrived in Baghdad in April of 2003. The first U.S. advisor to Iraq's Ministry of Industry and Minerals, retired Ambassador Timothy Carney, wanted to reopen many of the country's 192 state-owned factories, which, according to the World Bank, employed more than 500,000 people. L. Paul Bremer deemed it to be bad economic policy. He wanted private investors to buy the factories. But the hoped-for private investors never arrived. And now we have people shooting at us because they don't have jobs. And now Brinkley's trying to make this happen, and what's he being called? A Stalinist. 27 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Just Karl Marx who first started the idea that it all comes down to economics. And it goes back to Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. It goes back to the kings of ancient Europe. And we see it now today. General Eaton, here's the second ad now coming out from VoteVets. VoteVets.org. This is the guy, 33 years in the U.S. Army, who was in charge of establishing Iraqi security forces 2003 through 2004. He was the commanding general in charge of reestablishing Iraqi security forces. The new ad from VoteVets.
President Bush says he listens to his military commanders. Well, Mr. President, I was one of those commanders, and you weren't listening when we warned you of the dangers we'd face invading Iraq. Now our military is overcommitted, and America is less secure. Mr. President, you're being told we need serious diplomacy, not escalation. And you're still not listening. If the president won't listen, Congress must.
And this is the ad from VoteVets. And this is the very, very simple thing, is that we won the war, the illegal war, in on May 1st, 2003. That war took less than 2 months. We took down the country's government. We took down their military. We destroyed their military. We seized control of their institutions. We seized control of their factories. We seized control of their cities. We took control of their police departments. I mean, by any measure, we won the war. And then we began the occupation. And the idea that the neocons had for this occupation was, we will bring in transnational corporations, and they will, you know, the so-called free market will enthusiastically and excitedly rebuild Iraq because government can't do it. We're not going to do it the way that the Marshall Plan, the way that those Democrats did after World War II, where they simply loaned and gave grants of money, mostly grants of money, because the, you know, countries were not all that enthusiastic about the loans. I mean, this is why the World Bank was started, but it ended up rolling over into the Marshall Plan. To European countries to rebuild Europe, gave the money to the governments. The government and the government said, "Okay, we're going to need to rebuild cities, so we're going to hire our local companies to do it." And the neocons and the conservatives in this administration said, "No, we can't hire local. Are you kidding? We'll bring Halliburton in. They know how to do it. We'll bring in Bechtel. They've built the Trans-Alaska Highway. They know how to do things. They built a highway across Africa. I mean, they're very, very knowledgeable." And as a result, all these Iraqis are out of work. You get out of work Iraqis, you have a problem. Under pressure from Congress to demonstrate progress on the ground, this is Rajiv Chandrasekharan's article in today's Washington Post. Under pressure from Congress to demonstrate progress on the ground, the military often favors immediate solutions aimed at quelling violence. What's the best solution to quell violence? Give them jobs. The dispute between, and literally, I mean, this is how the article starts. Paul Brinkley, a deputy undersecretary of defense, has been called a Stalinist by U.S. diplomats in Iraq. One has accused him of helping insurgents build better bombs. The State Department has even taken the unusual step of enlisting the CIA to dispute the validity of his work. His transgression? To begin reopening dozens of government-owned factories in Iraq. How dare he? Brinkley and his colleagues at the Pentagon, these are the guys who are getting shot at. They're just saying, you know, well, forget ideology. What's going to work? Brinkley and his colleagues at the Pentagon believe that rebuilding shuttered state-run enterprises could reduce violence by employing tens of thousands of Iraqis. Officials at the State Department counter that the initiative is antithetical to free market reforms. You get how serious these ideologues are about this? They're willing to have 600,000 people die to prove that the Republic, that the Democrats were wrong with the Marshall Plan, that it was just a fluke. And instead, they're being demonstrated. They are being the ones who are being found wrong. Bremer wanted private investors to buy the factories, but the hoped-for private investors never arrived. Factories remained shuttered, and the Iraqi government whittled down the payroll subsidies. Why? Well, of course, because government should not be in a position of backstopping people. Government should only be in the position of punishing people. Some former workers found new jobs. Others, U.S. military officials believe, joined the insurgency. This is the Pentagon saying this! In the early months of the occupation, the State Department wanted to resuscitate the state-owned enterprises, but the Pentagon... Now, this is really interesting. In the first 2 months after the occupation, the pragmatists in the State Department said, let's take these state-owned factories and keep them running. But the Pentagon at that time was dominated by Don Rumsfeld and Doug Feith and Paul Wolfowitz and all these right-wing neoconservative ideologues who said, oh, no, the free market will solve all problems. Look at how wonderfully it's working in the United States. Stock market's up. More employment. Well, yeah, you know, it's greeters at Walmart, but still, hey. And you don't have people in the streets in America. I mean, we've quelled political opposition because people are working so hard, they don't have time to even pay attention to politics. And by turning the media over to big transnational corporations, everything's fine. We could do the same in Iraq. So initially, the State Department was saying, let's jumpstart the factories and get people back to work. And these ideologues in the Defense Department said no. The Pentagon's civilian leadership, dominated by neoconservatives, this is from the Washington Post, dominated by neoconservatives, rejected the idea of supporting government-run industry. By last year, the positions had been reversed. But because the Department of State, is now running the show in the green zone, the opposition carried the day. In other words, for 4 years, these factories have remained closed because we have not been saying, oh, gee, let's put people back to work. Then Brinkley arrived in Baghdad. After touring more than 50 facilities, Brinkley's team deemed about 20 worthy of repair, including factories that made car parts, textiles, leather goods, fertilizer, and handwoven rugs. When he revealed his plans at the embassy in Baghdad last fall, they bristled. Their reaction was, why is the Department of Defense in this space? You get this? The neocons, they're all upset. They're so upset that they threw him out. He's having to work outside. He has set up his own offices in another part of the green zone. I mean, that's how weird it's gotten. The dispute between State and Brinkley has become so pitched that he has effectively stopped working with the U.S. Embassy and is setting up his office elsewhere in Baghdad's fortified green zone. That from today's Washington Post. Conservatives are so desperate to prove that somewhere, somehow, someday, conservative economic philosophy will work, even though every single time it's tried, it produces a large class of working poor, a very small class of extremely rich, and no middle class whatsoever for all practical purposes, beyond a professional middle class of physicians and artists and you know, those who are lucky enough to get into a guild, the stonemasons, that kind of thing. Every time conservative philosophy, for 7,000 years, every time conservative economic philosophy has reigned, there has been no middle class. It has, for all practical purposes, wiped it out. If there was a strong and vibrant middle class in Iraq today, there would not be an insurgency. It's that simple. And this guy, Paul Brinkley, in the Department of Defense, an undersecretary of defense, has figured it out. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Well, you basically just said it, but your theory is working here in the U.S. The people are too busy working in the pursuit of perhaps the illusion they have, that hope that they can get out of this, you know, get up to the middle class or out of the middle class. They're too busy to rise up.
Yeah, well, and also, I mean, that's half of it. The other half of it is, as long as they have a job, they're not sticking people up.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's the best anti-crime program in the world is a job. And you could argue that the insurgency is crime writ large. I mean, it's a form of, you know, absolutely people out of control. And, you know, spot on, Jeff. I mean, this is really a two-edged sword. There's two sides to this. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott.
Good morning, Tom. It's another bright, sunny day here in Southern California. And our mayor, Katrina Sanders, is busy cleaning house down here. He's getting rid of the lower-income people so that there's more room for the 20 million people coming into Southern California by 2020. We're going to have a lot of real estate available here in Southern California. Well, of course, we've got the very wealthy here in San Diego and the working impoverished, the illegal immigrants that populate our restaurants, landscaping, yeah, et cetera, all over this town. Yeah. What he's doing, really, is he's cutting senior citizen services, therapeutic recreation services, HIV AIDS information, family services, legal aid community response team. But what's so ironic, Tom, is the city is currently owed $100 million by the Community Development Block Grant. $100 million. They already owe us $3.8 million right now.
This federal
Mayor Sanders had that money, Mayor Katrina Sanders had that money, we wouldn't have to cut these funds, but he won't ask for that from the developers. Now, I think he's driving out people so he can increase his voting base to the wealthy. What do you think?
I don't know because I don't live in San Diego, Scott, but, I'll take your analysis of it for the moment. Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve, just a half a minute here before we got to take a break.
Got it. Yeah, just got 3 points, pretty basic. One, I think there are a group of people who have the money necessary to take a rather cynical view of nations anyway. I think they set them up and knock them down pretty much to serve their own interests. I also think that middle class is going to be basically wiped out in favor of a global workforce that can be moved around wherever they need them.
Yeah, this is the whole neocon strategy. I mean, I wrote a book about this called Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. There really is a war against the middle class, to paraphrase Lou Dobbs, and my own book. And it's very real, and it has an ideological grounding as well as an economic one. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Days, 11 hours, 5 minutes, 16 seconds, until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office, barring impeachment or other proceedings or resignation. Well, I can tell you, here's one thing that I can absolutely guarantee, is that in the midst of this five-year conservative experiment, this attempt to prove that conservative economics actually works in Iraq, I mean, there were really two things here. The first was, you know, proving that our military can take down a country. We did that. Between the invasion in March and the May 1st on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln Declaration of Mission Accomplished, we actually did fight and win a war in less than 2 months. Took out the country. And then they said, okay, turn it over to the Wolfowitzes and the Feiths and the Pearls and the neocons of the world, the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds. Let's just prove that conservative economic policy works even better than liberal economic policies, the policies of John Maynard Keynes that were used to rebuild Europe. Let's prove it. And here we are 4 years into it, and I guarantee the news is going to get better. How can I guarantee that? Well, because ABC, again, the Australian Broadcast Corporation, although this is also being reported by the Los Angeles Times, but the Australian Broadcasting Corporation reporting just moments ago now, Iraq's Interior Ministry has decided to bar news photographers and camera operators from scenes of bomb attacks. Operations Director Brigadier General Abdel Karim Khalaf said, "This follows a recent decision by the Iraqi government to no longer release civilian casualty figures. Toss in the U.S. policy of not including the victims of bomb attacks in casualty counts, and soon we will all be able to pretend that there's progress in Iraq." Dave in Long Beach, California. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. I feel almost a little superfluous with this because your screener says you have mentioned Naomi Klein.
Yeah, her Year Zero article in The Nation magazine about, what, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
And how, it's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, I mean, Naomi Klein did the very best job of investigative reporting that I have ever seen with regard to this entire Iraq mess. And it had to do with this entire conservative plan, neoconservative and neoconservative plan, to use Iraq as a tabula rasa, as a blank slate on which they could write their version of economics. And, spot on for pointing it out, Dave. And what amazes me is that nobody else has picked it up. You know, it's just absolutely incredible. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a Frontline episode, you know, how the war is screwed up and how these inexplicable decisions like to fire the army were taken. And in the entire program, you know, you're wondering, well, why? And they didn't, you know, go over the economic part.
Yeah, and that's the basis of it. And you're so right in pointing it out. And you can easily Google this thing. Just Google Naomi Klein and Year Zero Iraq, or go to The Nation. I believe it's thenation.org is their website. And you can track it down. It's been maybe 2 years or so since Naomi Klein did that. It was an absolutely brilliant report. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
And, you know, it's so funny what you were talking about in terms of the Iraqis not allowing photographs, because Iraq is a very modern country, even though it's very backwards at the same time, and a lot of people have picture cell phones. So, I mean, they can try all they want. It's just not going to succeed. But speaking of Iraq, the vice president, according to Tony Snow, did not issue any ultimatum to Iran. He was just expressing United States policy about safe passage. This is, you know, they're as they said, when I had lunch with the ambassador to the European Union, or from the European Union a couple weeks ago, he said, you know, the United States tries to pick and choose what it wants in terms of international law, and that's just not acceptable to the European Union.
Yeah. Well, I think, we have a brief clip of Dick Cheney on the aircraft carrier and his message to Iran. It's coming along here someplace. I think it's, here it is. No, it's not. I'm sorry. Here it's there.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
There you go. So, another joke for the day.
But it is interesting that they're claiming that this really wasn't a threat. Please. I mean, he was, you know, rattling the saber. And then, of course, they said, well, yes, we'll negotiate with them around Iraq, but they have got to reduce their shipments of IEDs, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, they're not talking about Saudi Arabia and what they're shipping to the Sunnis. That's the focus on Iraq and Iran. There is also quite a bit of talk about the president doing his 2010 speech today, which means to reduce emissions by 20% in the next 10 years. Of course, it's interesting. This is juxtaposed
emissions?
Where Mayor Bloomberg is having his own conference on reducing greenhouse gases, et cetera. And of course,
emissions.
I'm sorry?
I didn't understand the word. You meant greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay. That's right. And what's interesting, of course, Bloomberg, who is very much considering a third-party run, even though he denies it, has talked to Chuck Hagel clearly about this, is doing his own greenhouse emissions conference. So the White House is sort of trying to take some of the wind out of the Bloomberg sail on that.
You know, Ellen, everybody's talking about Bloomberg and Hagel, or Hagel and Bloomberg, presumably, as a third-party ticket. Why not a Republican ticket? Why don't they just step in, in early January, just before the February primaries in the big states, and step in as the, you know, we're here to save you Republican ticket? I think that they'd probably take it.
That very, very well might happen. They may be putting forth the third party issue as a way of sort of raising their specter, but not necessarily talking about what their real plans are. If they're smart politicians, and I have every every belief that Bloomberg and Hagel are very, very smart politicians. That's exactly what your strategy says is what I think they may wind up doing.
And I'm of the opinion that Bush Sr. is behind Hagel in this. What do you think?
Nothing would surprise me. I don't think Bush Sr. is very happy with Bush Jr.
Yeah, but and Hagel's an old Bush Sr. protege, is he not?
Very, very much good friends and yeah. Part of that old Bush One network.
Yep. There you go. Thank you, Ellen Radner.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Countrywide Home Loan.
The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
So what's the cure for all this? Welcome back, by the way. What's the cure for all these ills that we're seeing from the disaster that we've been talking about in Iraq being played out actually as an economic policy initially? Or was it just a political policy? See, my personal opinion is that it was a confluence of things that you had George W. Bush himself, who back in 1999 was telling his biographer that his father's biggest mistake was ending the Iraq war or the Kuwait war 3 months too early. And that if he had only extended that war, he would have easily defeated Bill Clinton. Because war presidents are popular. And he said, if I have an opportunity to invade, I will not make that same mistake. I will have a successful war and a successful presidency and you know, all that kind of, his quote to Mickey Herskowitz, quite famous. So I think that for George W. and for Karl Rove, it was all about political power. For Dick Cheney, I think it was all about oil and money. You've got, you know, the Halliburton stock going from, what, 13, 14, 15, something like that, up into the 60s. And all his buddies becoming multimillionaires, multi-billionaires, getting richer and richer and richer. Now the company's even moving over to the UAE. And then, of course, you had the Wolfowitzes and the Feiths and the whole bunch of them in the Department of Defense who simply believe, you know, the PNAC crowd, the Project for a New American Century, including Jeb Bush, who believed that if they could transform a nation, a tabula rasa, into, you know, a blank slate, into a spectacular economic success and a political success, that if they could bomb a country into democracy, they could begin the transformation of the world, and frankly, with the best of intentions. Well, some would argue, I mean, anytime you get into, well, the ends justify the means, it's not the best of intentions, but nonetheless, they were suggesting that. By the way, the article by Naomi Klein that I had quoted earlier, turns out I was plugging The Nation, and it's actually in Harper's. So for those of you who are looking for it. But speaking of The Nation, John Nichols is with us. He writes for The Nation. He also has a new book out called The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. And John, a friend of this program, you've been on here before. Great to have you back with us, John.
It's great to be on with you, brother. And let me just suggest to you one thing. Bush may have been wrong about war presidents being popular.
Yeah, he should have asked Harry Truman. You know? I mean, if there's going to be a parallel, he really should have asked. He should have looked at Truman's presidency. But of course, when he got his history degree at Yale, that was back in the time. In fact, a friend of mine at MSU back in mm-hmm. the '60s actually started one of these businesses where it literally was a business where you could go to this company, and he did it right out in front, right out in open, where you would go to the business, and they would supply people to show up for you in class, to write your papers for you, and to take your tests for you.
Well, I think, I've actually talked to the professors who had both Cheney and Bush at Yale.
Uh-huh.
And the really scary thing is they say Bush was the smart one compared to Cheney.
And that he actually showed up?
Much better than Cheney. You know, Cheney.
I mean, how could he have shown up in history class and not known history?
Here, brother, and you know, I hate to tell you this, but in those days, when you got in because your grandpa was Prescott Bush, you didn't really have to try that hard.
Yeah.
And intriguingly enough, some of the Yale professors I've talked to have said that, frankly, the Yale History Department at that time wasn't all that great. It taught you to be an imperialist rather than taught you anything about American history.
Oh, that's interesting. It was history for the ruling class of people who send their kids to Yale.
There you go.
That's maybe yeah, now it's starting to make sense. Well, John Nichols, you have this new book out, The Genius of Impeachment: The Founder's Cure for Royalism. I have for the better part of 2 years been an advocate of impeachment because I believed that presenting a bill of impeachment to the House Judiciary Committee would then force that committee into the investigations that would reveal the crimes that could lead to the full House impeaching. For example, 33 years ago last month, the House Judiciary Committee voted to subpoena the White House tapes from Richard Nixon. None of the Republicans went along with that. All the Republicans were totally opposed to it. Nobody would even talk about impeachment. 5 months later, after they heard the tapes, all but, I believe, one, I might be wrong, it might have been two, but the majority of Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee voted to impeach Richard Nixon.
Actually, it wasn't quite as good as that.
Okay,
but on every one of the articles of impeachment against Nixon, a substantial number of Republicans did vote to impeach. In fact, the important thing, remember, in those days, Republicans weren't that strong in Congress. And so the critical thing was to get Southern conservative Democrats to vote to impeach as well. And so really what the tapes did was get the Democratic Party united behind impeachment and then bring enough thinking, responsible Republicans over to legitimize it as an action. And this is really one of the challenges we have to this day. The fact of the matter is that back in the summer of 1974, everybody in Washington knew that Richard Nixon was a crook. Everybody knew that he was impeachable. But they hadn't reached that sort of critical mass point where people were comfortable taking the action. Liberal Democrats were, but a lot of moderate and even conservative Democrats, as well as most Republicans, were not. We're in a sense at the same place today. I think everybody in Congress, except for really a handful of the craziest ideological Republicans, understands that Bush has committed impeachable acts. The problem is that we have not got the media that we had in 1974, which is tragic. We also don't have the aggressive, constitution-loving Congress that we had in 74. In 74, you had people like Sam Ervin and Peter Rodino, who may not have been liberals, but they loved the Constitution. Today, we have far too few of those folks.
Well, you even had, back then, you even had people like Barry Goldwater
and
Everett Dirksen, who mm-hmm. loved the kind. I mean, it was Barry Goldwater who went over to the White House, as I recall. Maybe I'm remembering the Russian Hitchhiker story. And sat down with Richard Nixon and said, "This is it, Dick. Time to mm-hmm. go." But in the last week or so, I have somewhat changed my thinking, or at least I've begun to... How to say this? It is becoming apparent to me that the word impeachment in and of itself was so contaminated by the Republicans in the impeachment of Bill Clinton, and perhaps intentionally so, anticipating mm-hmm. this moment, that in and of itself it doesn't have the juice it used to have. And so I'm if I were a Democratic political strategist right now, I would say, let's do the investigations. Let's get Monica Goodling in, you know, for that kind of thing. Let's find the crimes on the ground. And then when the crimes are so obvious that everybody in America gets it, then you introduce the bill of impeachment. And frankly, if I was a Republican strategist, if I was Karl Rove, I would be saying, please impeach Bush, because that will stop the investigations and prevent any, you know, and the odds of getting the vote in the Senate are zero. So he's not going to be convicted. So, you know, it stalls everything out. What do you think about this?
In a sense, you're exactly right, and you've come to the right point. And this is something I've advocated from the very start. I'm a passionate supporter of impeachment. I think it is absolutely not just a good idea, but a necessary idea. We cannot let this presidency finish with these powers having been attached to the presidency if we expect the next president to be a decent player. Don't tell me for a second that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or John Edwards are going to give up the powers that George Bush has accumulated to himself. They might use them somewhat more responsibly, maybe a lot more responsibly. But those of us who believe in the Constitution ought to favor impeachment not as a Republican or a Democratic act, but as an act to redeem the republic, as an act to take the powers of the presidency down so that they are in proper perspective with the Congress.
And we have a long history going all the way back to the Civil War of presidents never ceding power.
Exactly.
John Nichols, he's the author of The Genius of Impeachment. John, we have about a half a minute left here. What should be the short-term strategy? How should this thing be played out?
Those of us who back impeachment should push the investigation strongly. We should use the word impeachment, and we should educate about it. Use a simple analogy. Yes, the Republicans abused impeachment back in the 1990s. But tonight, thousands of people across the country will abuse aspirin. They will take three pills instead of two. They won't wait 4 hours, as they're supposed to, but fail the next pill. And yet, if I get a headache after talking to you, I'm still going to use aspirin. We don't throw cures out just because they've been abused.
Yeah, good point. Good point. John Nichols, the new book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. And many other writings of John's can be found over at thenation.com. John, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Great to be out with you, Tom. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, and you the same, sir. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Should we impeach George W. Bush? And if so, how? We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And that might be...
I'll be your sacrificial lamb. Serve me up with mint jelly and a side of ham. And while you're at it, Cheney too. For once, I'll just tell him what to do.
Yes, 21 minutes past the hour. That's Jim Turr, by the way, BlueCanyonSatire.com. He is going to be singing at our gig at the Greer Garson Theater. Jim's going to do a little song and dance, and then I'll do a song and dance and have a book signing and things. 2 o'clock, you can get information about that by listening to KTRC in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'll be there this coming week. So looking forward to that. Has George W. Bush committed impeachable crimes? Well, he's confessed to breaking the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA law. And this is a law that was passed by Congress that said that any federal official, any federal officer, which certainly includes the presidency, who wiretaps Americans, well, actually anybody, but specifically wiretaps Americans, without having it go through a court, and the FISA law actually set up a special court, and they said, well, you can even do it for 3 days without having a court order. But the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, which guarantees privacy, this is, you know, Americans shall be secure, or person, that people, actually. The Fourth Amendment doesn't even specify Americans. Most of the Constitution does not specify Americans. Most of it says, you know, people, persons. Says that you have the right to be secure in your person, in your personal papers and effects and articles in your home. And so if somebody is going to be wiretapped, there has to be a court order. And the FISA law says that any federal officer who breaks this law is subject to 2 years in jail and a $10,000 fine per crime, per incident. And George W. Bush has confessed to over 15,000 of these, bragged about it. He also has lied to the American people about, for example, the inspectors in Iraq. He said that he, now keep in mind, he was the one who said, pull the inspectors out because I'm going to begin bombing. Hans Blix going before the UN saying, you know, there's nothing there. There's nothing there. You know, back in the Middle Ages, they thought they found witches when they looked for them, but there were no witches. Similarly, there was no weapons of mass destruction.
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence, and I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
And he spoke before the United Nations just weeks before Bush said, okay, inspectors out. It was Bush who pulled the inspectors out. And then later he came and he told the American people this lie.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, did Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
Not true.
And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
After a reasonable request? No. I mean, this is just a flat-out, bald-faced lie. And, you know, not the only one, obviously. So do these things rise to the level of impeachability? Well, certainly if lying about sex in the White House does, then this is a slam dunk. Then it becomes the question of what's the best thing for the nation. I think that there's really two types of calculus that are being played out here. One is the partisan calculus. What's the best thing for the Democratic Party? And frankly, on the Republican side, what's the best thing for the Republican Party? I've talked to Democratic strategists off the record who have said to me that they believe that the number one thing that Karl Rove wants to have happen is a concerted effort by Democrats to impeach George W. Bush, because it'll take the heat off the real investigations into the real crimes that are being committed by the Republican Party, by people within the party, by senior officials in the party, and by individual Republicans who are holding elected office. In particular, Karl Rove. On the other hand, there's a good case to be made for, hey, let's have the discussion. Let's get this stuff out in the open, that when a bill of impeachment is brought forward, as it was during the Nixon era, that when it's brought forward, that initiates the investigation. I mean, otherwise it's this catch-22 of, well, you're not going to have the investigation because we're not going to have the investigation. And impeachment is not a removal from office. That's what happens in the Senate when the trial is held. The impeachment is the indictment. And impeachment is the equivalent of a grand jury convening and saying, is there enough evidence to charge this person with a crime? The impeachment is charging O.J. Simpson with a crime, for example. And then the trial happens in the Senate, just like the trial happened in court. And, you know, it might work, it might not. Bill Clinton was not removed from office. He was impeached, he was indicted. So should there even be the indictment? 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6-6-3-0-3-22-70. Join me in Dubrovnik, Croatia, for the Praxis Peace Conference, praxispeace.org, P-R-A-X-I-S, peace.org, the website. The conference title, Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community. Rhian Eisler, Tom Hayden, David Corton, Francis Moore LePace, Swami Vyandananda, a whole bunch of us going to be there. Louise will be there with me. Come hang out with us for a week. Also, this week, this Thursday, the 17th, I will be broadcasting live from KKZN, AM 760 in Denver, Colorado, at the Boulder Theater, 9 a.m. to noon Pacific time, noon to 3 Eastern time, the time that we're normally live. And in Santa Fe on the 19th, I'll be broadcasting the show live from the studios at KTRC on Friday morning, or Friday, the 18th. And then on the 19th, on Saturday, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the Greer Garson Theater, a presentation and book signing. And you can get more information about that by listening to KTRC if you are in that area. Michael in the Bronx, New York. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Tom. How you doing, guy? You know, in answering your question of should we impeach Bush, I say absolutely, as well as Cheney, Rove, and everyone else in the Bush crime family. You've noted so many different crimes that this administration has done. They're so anti-law and anti-constitution. And the thing that I fear the most is that with just 2 years down the line, you know, you're giving the countdown of how much time they have left in office. My fear is that they would do something or say something to try to override the term limits and not voluntarily leave office. It's up to the American people to finally take action against them and to make sure they do get out of office one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. It seems to me that if we have serious investigations, I don't disagree with you altogether. And I'm frankly very, very concerned about the, you know, what do you do with a cornered rat? I mean, that whole problem of the cornered rat. This, you know, as Brzezinski was talking about, you know, what he expects might well happen.
Of Iraqi failure to meet the benchmarks, followed by accusations of Iranian responsibility for the failure, then by some provocation in Iraq or a terrorist act in the United States blamed on Iran, culminating in a quote-unquote defensive U.S. military action against Iran that plunges a lonely America into a spreading and deepening quagmire, eventually ranging across Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan.
Brzezinski said...
tip of the hat to existentialistcowboy.blogspot.com. Brzezinski talking about, you know, how this might play out. Is Iran next? Or would impeachment stop that? Ted in New York City. Hey, Ted.
Yes, I was kind of disappointed in your guest you had on there just a couple of minutes ago, Nichols.
John Nichols, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how could he say that the impeachment of Clinton was wrong? Now, I was a Democrat at that time, and I thought that Clinton should have been impeached. It should have been, you know, removed from office. And people don't realize that it wasn't what he did. It's what Nixon did also, the cover-up, perjury, obstruction of justice.
Sure.
I think he should.
So if a president is impeached for lying before a grand jury about having sex with somebody, should a president be impeached for, now we know from the Downing Street minutes, we know that when George Bush said these words, he knew that they were not true.
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction, to cease all development of such weapons, and to stop all support for terrorist groups. The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons.
And then he went on to say,
facing clear evidence of peril.
Clear evidence.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
At the time that there was actually a very lively debate, as George Tenet points out in his own book, within the administration of the CIA about whether or not those aluminum tubes could be used for enriching uranium, because they were for rockets. They were the wrong diameter, and you know the CIA was basically saying, no, you got nothing here.
Okay, I'm not disputing that.
The weapons inspector saying you got nothing here. So are you suggesting that if Clinton was impeachable for what he did, that Bush is like 100 times more impeachable?
Oh, without a doubt. And in fact, let's go back even before Clinton. Let's go back to Ronald Reagan with Iran-Contra. Who do you think supplied the weapons to the Mujahideen, you know, so that we could train these people? And that's where they learned to make bomb making.
Sure.
And, yeah. and he violated
no, we
the
were supporting
event.
We were supporting Osama bin Laden because he was taking out the Soviets.
Right.
I'm saying,
I mean, what's the expression that Johnny Cochran used? If the glove fits the crime or whatever.
And well, actually, his was a negative. It was if it doesn't fit, you can't convict.
I say convict.
Okay. It's a good point. And the question is, how do you do it? How do you do it? What is the process that you go through? I think that, frankly, we have to have a consensus among the American people. I think that there has to be a broad consensus among the American people, or it's going to go nowhere. It's going to seem like a crackpot effort. And that's not going to be a good thing. So, on the other hand, there is a growing consensus. John in Pittsburgh, for example. John, you wanted to point out something about a graduation speech that Bush was at. John?
Hello?
Hey, John, you're on the air.
No.
No? Okay, you're not. All right. Kathy in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Kathy.
Hi there. Hey, you know, this has nothing to do with that. I've been waiting too long. The reason maybe Bloomberg is running on an independent ticket is I wouldn't have anything to do with the Republican Party today either.
Bloomberg is a Republican.
Pardon?
Bloomberg is a Republican. I don't think he's going to run as an independent.
I think he's going to run as a Republican. Against my own party just to get away from the Republicans right now. They're not doing so good.
Yeah. Well, see, that's why I think that Bloomberg and Chuck Hagel are going to roll in at the last minute and save the Republican Party from itself. And frankly, I think that there's a lot of folks in the Republican Party who are going to embrace that and say, yes, we do need to be saved from it. Barbara in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Barbara.
Hey, Tom. I wonder why you haven't introduced the idea that Marshall Plan to Bernie Sanders when you have him on.
We've discussed that. You mean for Iraq? Let's rebuild Iraq from the ground up. Yeah, I don't want to quote him because I don't remember the exact words, but my recollection is that Bernie is entirely in favor of something like a modern day Marshall Plan for Iraq. And that's frankly what we need to do is we need to put people back to work. When people have jobs, they don't shoot at you. I mean, this is fairly simple stuff. This is not rocket science. Lerone in New York City. Hey, Lerone.
Hi, how are you? I'm calling to follow up on the comment that the caller before the last made.
Mm-hmm.
As a Democrat, I kind of felt that Clinton needed to be impeached, not because of, for no political reason other than the fact that he lied under oath, and that is a crime under our system. And he should have been impeached. But
the Constitution. Here's my take on this, Lerone. I believe that Clinton should have been censured. There should have been a resolution of censure. He should have had his hand slapped. The Constitution calls for impeachment in cases of treason, high crimes, and misdemeanors. And the definition of misdemeanors in 1776 was something like the equivalent of murder. You know, I mean, serious major crimes. Lying to a grand jury under oath is a serious crime, and Bill Clinton lost his law license over it. But I don't think that it's something for which he should have been removed from office because it had nothing to do with how he was conducting his office. I think that he should have been censured for it. I don't think he should have been impeached.
I
think it was overkill.
Right. In the situation with school delivery, all the Democrats, we are saying, okay, he should have been found guilty. He should have been convicted. He should lose his job and all these other things. But under Clinton, it seems like we didn't say that. We said, okay, we're going to make an exception because it wasn't related to his job, and he's a nice guy. We like him, and we're paying the price for it now.
No, Clinton actually was convicted of, as I recall, of lying before a grand jury. He took some sort of a minor sentence. He lost his law license in Arkansas as a consequence of it. I mean, you know, he paid the consequence of doing that, but it was a small crime. It was not a crime that involved the death of 600,000 human beings. It wasn't a crime that involved, you know, laying waste to an entire region, destroying the integrity of the American reputation all around the world. It wasn't a crime that has cost this nation so much in cash. I mean, in addition to all the blood that I just laid out, and, you know, 25,000, you know, injured and severely injured, and we're looking at hundreds of thousands of people coming back with less visible, more subtle, but still long-lasting, life-changing injuries, the destruction of or the damaging of our National Guard and of our, you know, right across the board. In addition to that, you know, running this country into $1 trillion in debt as a consequence of this, at least. And where's that money coming from? He's borrowing it from our children and our grandchildren. I mean, these are not just crimes, and on top of that, you know, doing away with posse comitatus, doing away with habeas corpus, breaking into our homes for all practical purposes without court orders and then without warrants and then bragging about it. I mean, these are things that really I believe he should be held accountable for. I don't know how to say it beyond that. 45 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
There's a dark and a troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
Oh, wouldn't it be nice just to be looking at the sunny side? Yeah, just thinking about the positive things in life.
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons.
Well, maybe they're not as dangerous.
While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
And again, we now know that when he said this, he knew it wasn't true.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
And he said that at the time that there were weapons inspectors inside Iraq, and they were reporting back that there's nothing here. There's nothing here. And we are not being obstructed. We're being allowed to go anywhere we want, anytime we want. We're catching people sound asleep. And Saddam Hussein was actually blowing up his own rockets because they were 13 kilometers over the range, the 100-kilometer range, mile, whichever it is, I'm translating one to the other backwards, blowing them up. I mean, here's a guy who his major accomplishment of his last year of his presidency was he was writing a novel. He's writing a epic romance novel, which is now oddly enough in print. And this is what we had to take out. This is worth 3,300 American lives. This is worth 25,000 Americans injured. This is worth 600,000 Iraqis dead. This is worth turning America into a pariah around the world. This is worth draining our treasury to the point where we're becoming like a third world nation in terms of our relationship, debt relationship with the rest of the world. Somehow I don't think so. Linda in San Diego. Hey, Linda.
Hey, how you doing? I don't want to belabor the point, but I'm just going to mention this. I take this impeachment thing from one angle I haven't heard anybody mention yet, and that is that in the case of the Clinton administration, we would not even have known that the guy was getting a little something under the desk unless the Republicans had spent millions upon millions of our dollars and every waking minute, instead of trying to run the government, trying to find something to pick on him for.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't like
the Christmas card list. They held a congressional investigation of his Christmas card list, a congressional investigation of whether or not he fired the wrong travel agent.
Oh, I know, that's what I mean. Every 5 minutes it was, we're looking into this and this and this and this. And finally it's like, okay, so the guy comes from a troubled background, maybe he has a little bit of peccadillo problem. Any married man asked, are you messing around, is probably not going to go, oh, yeah, absolutely, under the desk last night, it was cool. They're going to say, no. And so, like you said, it's one thing to go, dude, you don't lie. You should have just said, yes, I did, and I got work done that day. But you don't lie about it. However, to even remotely equate the kind of subjugation of the democratic system of Reagan or of Nixon, or, my God, what Bush has been doing from day one, Bush and his cronies, not even mentioning the things they've done to turn upside down every safety, every social net, every protection of the environment, going into the historical records and changing history, reclassifying things. I mean, just massive crime after massive crime, plunging us into a corporate fascist hybrid with fundamentalist theocracy or whatever, and people are going to go, yeah, well, that's the same as Clinton getting a little extra. It's just insane. So yeah. Thanks, and you're doing a great job.
Thank you, Linda. Well said. Very well said. Warren in Manhattan. Hey, Warren.
Hey, Tom. I want to weigh in on the same note as Linda, because, you know, people that have to really do things like, you know, who say things like, oh, Clinton did this and that, they have to do things like read the Federalist Papers to see what impeachment was about. Yeah. And they have to also, you know.
Impeachment was the ultimate remedy. It was the ultimate way of stopping a president who was out of control. It really had nothing to do with whether or not somebody was morally fit or whether they had broken some law. It is whether their law breaking was affecting the future course of the republic.
The workings of government. And, you know, and another thing that you pointed out once before, which I'll remind everyone of again, when Madison was speaking before the Congress, he said one of the worst things a president can do, one of the things you most need the impeachment remedy for, is when a president fires competent people. Gets rid of competent people. This is the U.S. attorney firing.
Yes.
You know, this is the one thing, you know, when you like go through, what are the remedies in the structure, this constitutional structure we have? Then you start to see where there are gaps, and then you see the room for impeachment. It's not about lying about sex. And not only that, but, you know, when you talk about the world reputation in the United States, what they went after Clinton for made us the laughingstock of the world. I mean,
sure.
You know, a guy with all the power in the world has sex with an intern. I mean, for God's sakes, what is wrong with this
country? And then he goes to the funeral of the French president whose wife is standing next to the French president, the dead French president's mistress. And, you know, the French are looking at us going, you know, what's, you know, come on, you guys. Linda in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Linda.
Hello. I want to say that impeaching now is the most important thing in the world. We cannot wait for investigations to make their slow way. I was sitting on the watching the committee when Waxman's committee voted to subpoena Condoleezza Rice, and she says she's not inclined to honor that. So that's why we need to impeach. It is the strongest subpoena available. You know, we are talking about our living without a constitution, and without it, we have nothing in this country. Every day that we live outside the rule of law makes being an outlaw nation normal. And what we need to do now is not nibble around the edges, but go for full impeachment investigations. Let the indictment begin, full investigations, and we need to roll back 5 years of state of emergency, the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, the spying program, the war, and we need to go after it as if our life depends on it, because it does.
Because it does. Well said, Linda. And let's take our country back here. In the process, let's go back to the values that built this country. Coming up tomorrow, Chris Mooney on his book, Storm World, Hurricanes, Politics, and the Battle Over Global Warming. And we'll have an interesting conversation with conservative Mike Evans on the premise of his new book, The Final Move Beyond Iraq, The Final Solution While the World Sleeps. Final solutions? Yes. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.